Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Whether you're a new listener or have been subscribing since the beginning, we're glad that you're here. Please continue to tell your friends about the podcast. Our listenership grows through your help. Remember that you don't need an iPod to listen. Any computer with speakers will do. This week, Rabbi Schweiger will discuss Parshat Ki Tisa. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's parsha is Parshat Ki Tisa, the central topic being the sin of the golden calf. Let us examine the opening verses of chapter 32, which discuss the creation of the golden calf. Vayar ha'am, the people saw, ki voshesh Moshe laredet minahar, that Moshe is delayed in coming down from the mountain. Vayikahel ha'am al Aharon, and the people gather upon Aaron. Vayomru elav, and they say to him, kum ase lanu Elohim, get up, make us gods. Asher yelchu lefanenu, who will walk before us. Ki ze Moshe ha'ish, because this Moshe, the man, Asher ha'elanu me'eretz Mitzrayim, who brought us up from the land of Egypt, lo yadanu mehayalo, we don't know what has become of him. This verse is the heading for the whole section of the golden calf, the key. Let us examine this phrase by phrase in order to understand what was going on. Vayar ha'am, the people see. Am is a way of referring to the people, looking at them as a mass of people. In the beginning of the book of Shemot, Pharaoh is the first one to refer to the Jewish people as an am. Hinei am b'nei Yisrael, rav v'atzum mimenu. Behold, the Am of the Jewish people is numerous and too powerful for us. This is said in response to the unbelievable population explosion of the Jewish people, mentioned in verse 7. In a number of places in the Chumash, Rashi quotes the rabbinic understanding that Am very often is a pejorative term. It looks at the Jewish people in terms of the masses, the lowest common denominator, as opposed to, for example, Eida, which is a reference to the Jewish people as an elite group. And hence, you have Midrashic comments that say that the driving force behind the creation of the golden calf was in fact the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude, who were appended to the Jewish people when they left the land of Egypt. But even if we assume that the Am are not foreigners who join the Jewish people, but native Jews, the Am nevertheless refers to a grassroots movement, something which is not initiated by the leadership, but by the grassroots and perhaps by the fringe elements of those grassroots. What does the Am see? Moshe is delayed in coming down the mountain. Rashi quotes a Midrashic comment which says that when Moshe went up the mountain, he said to the people, at the end of 40 days, in the first 6 hours of the day, I will come back to you. And the people thought that the day that Moshe went up should be considered to be the first day of the counting. But they made a mistake. And hence, on the 16th day of Tammuz, the people anticipated Moshe's return. And then Satan came and confused the world. And the middle of the day made it appear that there was darkness and confusion, saying, Moshe has certainly died. And therefore, this is why there is this confusion in the world. Satan said to them, Moshe has died. Behold, 6 hours of the day have gone by, and he did not return. This rabbinic understanding says that the golden calf was rooted in a miscalculation. The people expected Moshe to return on the 16th day of Tammuz, by a certain hour. And when he delayed, and there's a play on words, boshesh, as bishesh, at the sixth hour of the day, when he did not come back, the deadline being up, all of a sudden, the world has turned dark. In rabbinic literature, Satan is very often used as a metaphor for the evil inclination, for the doubts within a person, so that when Moshe is not coming back, all of a sudden, the people have doubts. The world becomes dark. The world becomes desolate. The people's doubts turn into anxieties. The anxieties into trauma. The people imagine the worst. Moshe is dead. And if Moshe is dead, their whole world has fallen apart. What I would like to highlight is that, first of all, there may not be an objective problem. Because, in fact, Moshe was not scheduled to return on that day. He was supposed to come back the day after. So that the whole thing may be just a figment of the imagination of the people. But even if Moshe was scheduled to come back on that day, there is this snowball effect of going from a problem to a crisis. And perhaps I would say the people have created an artificial crisis. By letting their imaginations run wild, the people have taken a problem, which is Moshe's delay in returning, and made it into a major crisis. Moshe is certainly dead. We have no leadership. We are now stuck to die in the desert. But is this true? We find in the continuation of the verse, Vayikahel ha'am al Aharon, the people gather on Aaron. The term lehikahel al is not that the people have gathered to Aaron, that the people have gathered, coming to him, seeking his guidance, but the people have gathered on him. The imagery is of an unruly mob, threatening, who are not seeking, but demanding. Why are they going to Aaron? Well, as we see in chapter 24, when Moshe went up the mountain, before he goes up, he says to the elders in chapter four, in sentence four, in verse 14, stay here until I come back. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Anyone who has a dispute shall approach them. Which means that Moshe did not leave the Jewish people without a leadership. There are the elders. But even more significantly, there is Aaron. Aaron has been Moshe's partner throughout the whole Exodus story. Aaron was a figure that was very visible to the people. So that if Moshe is not there, Aaron is. And therefore, if there is a problem, even if there is a crisis, the natural place to turn is to Aaron, to bring to him their anxieties, to seek his guidance. But the people don't do that. Instead, they come to Aaron, and the first thing which they say to him is, "Get up." In the Tanakh, whenever it says, "Get up," it's because somebody is not doing perhaps what they should be doing, because they're reluctant to do it. By analogy, in the book of Jonah, when God tells Jonah, "Go to the city of Nineveh," Jonah does not want to go. He runs away. God needs to exhort him. Kum, lech el Nineveh, get up and go to Nineveh. By the same token, the people see that there is a crisis, or imagine that there is a crisis. But Aaron is not doing anything. So the people look at him and say, "Why are you just sitting around? Do something. Get up." And what is it that they want him to do? "Make for us gods who will walk before us, because Moshe the man is not with us." What do the people want? Rashi, quoting a midrash, says, "Elohut harbei ivulahem." Many gods they desired. Which means that the people are looking for a god. Not just one god, many gods. The people are in a mode of idolatry. This idea can be seen in a verse in the book of Psalms, chapter 106, verse 2. "Vayamiru et kvodam betavnit shor ochel esev," and they exchange their glory for the form of an ox who eats grass. But in a more graphic fashion, we find this in Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer, a collection of midrashim ascribed to the Tana Rabbi Eliezer, in chapter 45. Which says, when the Jewish people receive the commandments, after 40 days they forgot their God, and they came and said to Aaron, "The Egyptians used to carry their gods all around. They used to sing and revel before their gods. They would see their gods in their presence. Make us gods like the Egyptian gods, that we should see him before us. As it says, get up and make us gods." Rashi, based on the Midrashim, says that the Jewish people are seeking gods. And if we take Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer, the Jewish people are using Egypt as their model. The Egyptians had portable gods that were visible. We need something visible, concrete, that we can relate to. Nachmanides, in his commentary, focuses on the phrase, "Asher yelchu lefanenu," who will walk before us, and says that in fact the people are not looking for gods to worship. The people are looking for leaders, a leader. The expression of walking before us appears in a few places in the Tanakh with respect to a king who leads the people. We see this in the book of Samuel. So that, according to Nachmanides, the people were looking for a replacement of Moshe, of another leader. I would like to suggest, in true Jewish fashion, that both of these explanations are correct. The people, in fact, are looking for a replacement of Moshe, another leader. But in order to understand what they want, perhaps we need to understand their image of Moshe. Moshe is not just a leader. For the Jewish people, Moshe was larger than life. With all the miracles that he performed in the Exodus, climaxing at the revelation at Sinai, when the people say to Moshe, "You speak to us rather than God," at that point, Moshe becomes a replacement for God. And on a certain level, this idea has its origin in what God said to Moshe when he first began his mission in chapter 7, verse 1. When God says to Moshe, "Behold, I have made you into a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother will be a priest." And although Pharaoh does not relate to Moshe as a god, the Jewish people did. They saw Moshe as being much more than just a human being. Hence, when we look at our verse, and the people say, "Because this Moshe the man," perhaps we can understand that the trauma which the Jewish people are experiencing is the shattering of an image. For them, Moshe was a god. All of a sudden, they're beginning to realize that perhaps he is just a man. And as just a man, he is mortal and has left them. And therefore, what do they want? They want a god to be their leader. A god who will always be there, who will never leave them, who is larger than life. But that perception is rooted in idolatry. Let me elaborate. There seems to be a paradox in the people saying, "Make for us gods." We know from chapter 1 of Bereshit, human beings are created in the image of God. But here it seems to be a reversal. God is created in the image of man. And perhaps this is at the core of the difference in theology between a pagan society and Judaism. In Judaism, God is at the core of existence. Everything emanates from God. Human beings are in the image of God. Human beings are seen. Their role is to serve God. God is the king. We are the servants. God commands. We execute. This is a major theme throughout the Chumash. We serve God because God is almighty, because God is all-powerful. We are in awe of God. We recognize our limitations. But what the Jewish people are expressing over here is a pagan concept. Man, humanity, is at the core of existence. The gods are made in the image of man. Perhaps I would take this even one step further. The gods are there to serve man. when people worship gods in a pagan society, it is not because the people are in awe of those gods, because the people feel committed to those gods. They want to have a relationship with those gods. Worship of the gods is really self-worship. In a number of places in his commentary, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch says that in the pagan view, prayer, sacrifices, is a way of manipulating the gods. You basically start out with a human being who has certain needs, certain desires. And the human being says, in order to be able to achieve those needs and desires, I need to press the right buttons. So that prayer becomes a way of manipulation. It is what we would call the rules of the game that I have to play in order to get my desire. And this is what's happening now. The Jewish people look at Egypt as their model and are reflecting a pagan worldview. But I want to take this one step further. In a number of podcasts, I have discussed the concept of going from slavery to freedom. And in many ways, what's happening at the Golden Calf is reflecting the slave mentality of the Jewish people. After all that the Jewish people have been through, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, the revelation at Sinai, the covenantal agreement with God, the Jewish people have not become completely transformed into being a free people. And let me elaborate. A person who is free is someone who is truly in control of a situation. I mentioned at the beginning that the Jewish people have a problem. And according to the Midrash, it is a perceived problem, not an objective problem. But the Jewish people blow up a problem and make it into a crisis. A free person who is in control of a situation does not allow his imagination to run wild, but is able to assess what is really going on and how do I now go ahead and deal with it. A slave who is not in control of his reality experiences the loss of control, magnifies the loss of control, and in some cases may use artificial means to imagine that they are in control. As the people here say, come, make us gods. Yes, we will make gods, and by creating these things, that will somehow empower us, make us feel like we're really in control of the situation. But it is illusory. It is a situation of a person who magnifies the problem and in so doing loses control and then tries to compensate by creating something artificial, imaginary, that will give them that control. And perhaps this is also at the heart of idolatry. In our very parsha, after the golden calf, there is a very interesting phrase which appears. This is in chapter 34, verse 17, where God says, Elohim masecha lo ta'aselach. Gods with masks do not make to you. And perhaps this is a profound expression of what idols are. They're a mask. They're an illusion. One could say a panacea. Something which makes us feel good. if I go back to the Midrash of Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, in Egypt they had gods which they saw, which they could sing before, which they could revel in. And because they saw them, they were empowered by them. They were a crutch, a support. They were a substitute for action. And what do I mean by that? I mentioned earlier that if in fact there really was a problem over here, the Jewish people had lines of communication. Aaron is their leader. The Jewish people could come to Aaron, seek his guidance. The Jewish people could turn to God and pray. The Jewish people could have had patience. What is so burning? There is no lack of water. There is no lack of food. The Jewish people could wait another day, maybe even more than a day. They could wait to and listen to Aaron and receive his guidance. But the Jewish people want a solution now. They don't want to wait. And this is the problem of idolatry. Instant gratification. As I mentioned before, it is self-serving. It is an illusory sense of being in control to compensate sometimes for an illusory lack of control. It is a panacea that does not really confront problems in a responsible way. And once again, let me interject. The Jewish people, after all the experiences which they've had, have entered into a covenantal relationship with God. A covenant means commitment, responsibility, relationship. In this story, the Jewish people do not show that commitment, that relationship. And what is happening here, the Jewish people are totally oblivious to God. Even worse, are obnoxious. And as I mentioned, are in fact reflecting a slave/pagan mentality, which is focused on me, which is, does not include the other and a sense of responsibility to the other, but is always focused on me and how can I promote myself. The people who so much want gods, who feel so distraught at the absence of Moshe, are not really upset that Moshe is no longer here and really care about Moshe. What they're upset with is, where does that leave them? So that if I were to summarize what is wrong in the story of the golden calf, at its core, it basically demonstrates that the Jewish people have not really made the transition from slavery to freedom. After all that the Jewish people have been through, they still have that slave mentality. They may have left Egypt, but Egypt has not left them. They still have a pagan perception, which is looking for gods, many gods. And why many gods, as Rashi says? Because the many gods are what enables them to be empowered in the variety of situations that they find themselves. Because in every situation where there is a problem, they need a new god to help them solve that problem. But to solve the problem in an illusory way, because it is not forcing them to really take control of the situation and confront it, but in many ways to run away from the situation and imagine that they have now dealt with it. And this reaches its climax in our section, when Aaron builds the calf and proclaims to the people in verse 5, "Let us make a celebration to Hashem tomorrow." Aaron in no way says to them, "Let us worship the calf." Aaron says, "Let us worship Hashem tomorrow." He builds an altar which is meant to be an altar to Hashem. And what are we told in the next verse? Vayashkimu mimachorat, they get up early in the morning. Vayalu olot, vayagishu shlamim, they bring burnt offerings, they bring peace offerings. Note the fact that burnt offerings and peace offerings were brought by the people in chapter 24 at Mount Sinai, when they entered into their covenantal relationship with God. But at Mount Sinai, the offerings were brought to God. Here, the offerings are just brought. It doesn't say to whom. But what's even more striking is it says, "Vayeshev ha'am," and the people sat down, "le'echol v'shato," to eat and drink, "vayakumu litzachek," and they arose to sport. And perhaps I would like to conclude with the following points. It says the people got up to sport, which clearly is parallel to the people saying to Aaron, "Get up, make us gods." And although the word litzachek, Rashi says, can have the connotation of sexual immorality, it can have the connotation of murder. And Rashi quotes proof texts. Litzachek clearly also is used in the context of idolatry. If we just take the word litzachek, tzchok, laughter, but litzachek is the idea of frivolity, lightheadedness, something which isn't serious. And perhaps that explains what's happening here. The creation of the golden calf is not serious. It is not truly worship of God. As I mentioned, it is an illusion. Yes, we go through the motions of worship, but in reality, it is total abandonment. The people sit down, they eat, they drink. The imagery that we have is that there has been a total breakdown in the Jewish camp. There is merrymaking. And I would like to just interject, this idea of drinking clearly has echoes in the Megillah, Megillat Esther. We have just celebrated the holiday of Purim. Masks, disguises, costumes are a major part of Purim. And there's a very interesting analogy between the reality of Purim and the reality of the golden calf. People drink. Drinking is used as a way of, quote-unquote, confronting and dealing with problems. But we know that it is just an escape. It doesn't really solve the problem. People create masks. They hide behind the masks. But there comes a certain point where the masks fall, where reality becomes revealed. One could even say where the nakedness, the vulnerability, the disempowerment become visible. That happens in the story of Purim, where ultimately Haman and Achashverosh, the masks fall. Ultimately Esther's mask falls. But the result of that is Esther becomes empowered because she takes control of her destiny. She doesn't just drink, but she has to confront a very difficult situation and tell the king who she really is. Tell the king what really needs to be done. To run the risk of possibly dying because this is what she believes in. The Jewish people here do not want to run the risk, do not want to struggle. They want to be given a God, many gods, an easy way out to solve all their problems. That is a slave mentality. And when Moshe comes down the mountain, the party ends. And all of a sudden, the people realize the tragic mistake that was made. I would just like to conclude with one last point. I mentioned at the beginning that the Am is a reference to the masses. And they were the driving force behind this. Where is the leadership? And maybe even one step further. We find in the continuation of the story, 3,000 men are killed. What could be called the hardcore of the Jewish people. The hardcore of the worshippers of the golden calf. But we know that 600,000 men left Egypt. What is the silent majority doing about the golden calf? It seems to be that the bulk of the Jewish people did not participate in the golden calf, but nevertheless allowed it to happen. And this is also a very serious consideration. What does it mean to have a people, to have a leadership that allows the marginal elements to set the agenda, to set the tone? It is a total reversal of the way things should be. Aaron, the elders, the vast majority of the Jewish people should have put things in order, but didn't, and allowed the charade to go on, which is why in the end, the Jewish people as a whole are condemned, because complicity is tantamount to action. The golden calf was not a one-time phenomenon. Idolatry was not a passing phase of history. This is an ongoing phenomenon which still exists today. Let us learn what it is to be free, to see the world for the way it is, to learn what it is to grapple with problems, and not to imagine illusory solutions. Let us learn what it is to have a sense of commitment and to persevere in those commitments. If we are able to learn from the golden calf, we can truly create a reality where the presence of God is manifest and where we truly actualize our human dignity. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email via podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.